This episode of FemmeMeta has been brought to you by Copper and Kings, copperandkings.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to
Foment About It
on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Mary Izette.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented. Archived here on heritageradionetwork.org as well as iTunes and Stitcher. All right, so tonight we have a very special guest, Nancy Singleton Hachisu.
Good job, Mary.
I'm the queen of mispronunciation. So thanks for being on.
Thank you for having me.
So you live in Japan.
Yes.
But you're in town for a few days.
I'm here to do a miso making class at Brooklyn Kitchen.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about what you do in Japan.
Well, I've been there for 27 and a half years. I live on a farm. My husband's family are farmers. Have been for, I'm going to say about, I don't know, how many generations? 40, 50. that doesn't mean that they've been madly growing vegetables and selling them. They were silkworm farmers until the business moved off site. I mean, so it was no longer cottage industry in Japan. Probably went to China, Thailand, who knows where. My husband's father changed to becoming, he was raising chickens for eggs. My husband's business became a free-range egg business, which I was destroyed by the big snowstorms last year. And now he is growing soybeans and wheat for an organic soy sesame miso tofu company in our town. And we're bringing that to America now.
Oh, the tofu itself?
Or? Not the tofu yet, no. But that actually is coming on a limited basis. But yeah, the soy sauce and miso.
Okay. Oh, awesome. So yeah. You guys are producing the wheat.
I am not producing anything. I am writing and I have a little school.
Your farm is?
Yeah, my husband is growing for them, for the soy sauce miso company. They've been selling to the United States on a different label. Now they're going to be selling under their label. They've been doing this for over 100 years. They've been organic for almost 50, and it's incredibly beautiful company. And so I'm just helping them out. With promotion and things like that. And that's one of the main reasons I'm in the States this time. But I always put in a trip to Brooklyn, well, New York, but less Brooklyn, yes, let's say that, okay, because I figure there's something's going to happen, and sure enough,
yeah,
it does, like this interview.
Yes, absolutely. So you teach at a school?
I have a little immersion preschool.
Okay.
Yeah. We moved out of our... I was teaching English originally and also teaching cooking, and we had our own house separate from the parents-in-law's house, and there came to a point after about 10 years just feeling like I just didn't want to have the work and the living situation. We have three sons, and I didn't want it to have it together. So after much discussion, decided to renovate the parents-in-law's farmhouse and live with them separately but together. We had separate areas. This intergenerational living has really I don't want to say it's completely extinct in Japan, but it's like many things and like all modernization of countries, it has definitely become less and less not a normal model. There's a lot more old age homes. But we renovated the farmhouse to make it both more modern and more Japanese.
Right.
Because the 70s type of renovations were kind of schlocky and took out traditional stuff for this quasi-modern type of metal and not nice renovations. So we sort of tried to get back the heart of Japan. We got some heating in and a kitchen that's not a little postage stamp, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. So awesome. I don't know what the original question was, but
so you have several books out.
Two. Yes. I do have several books out. Japanese Farm Food was the first book. That was essentially, I've never seen a cookbook that had my husband's way of cooking, or even my good friend Konchan, who has a restaurant, way of cooking. And I'm much more I was on the red eye last night, by the way.
Yes. So, no worries. Yeah,
I can speak English. I really can. So, I find male cooking much more appealing than Japanese women cooking, because I like a more bold, direct flavor. It's maybe a little bit I can't even think of it. It's not prejudicial, but what's the word? Stereotypical. Yeah, so maybe it's a little bit stereotypical, but older Japanese women tend to have a much more sweet palate. And because they won't necessarily be drinking with it, and we do tend to, you know, have some sort of alcohol when we have dinner, you know. Men's cooking has a just slightly different approach. And also, as a farm family, and my husband's been cooking most of his life, as have I, because he grew up in a family of sons, and so his grandmother taught him to cook. And so there's this sort of like misinformation floating about. Some writers say that I learned from my mother-in-law. Writers in Japan or writers in the United States, it's just not true. You know, I learned from my husband, who learned from his grandmother. Yeah. And then so Japanese Farm Food was about our family food, an approach to Japanese food that's very straight. It comes directly from the field. We get a bunch of carrots, and we're going to do one thing with them, and we're going to just make this huge bowl of it, you know. It's not a really fussy treatment. And then also, we've been using this organic soy sauce miso all of my married life, and my husband used it before he met me. So it's also all about the ingredients, and shaving katsuobushi, and just, you know, keeping things simple. So that book, and then I also tried to introduce the Japan that I know, which is again a direct. You know, Japanese people are kind of pretty much the same as you and I are, but there's this rep about the control type of personality, and you have to be so careful about what you do. You can hug people in Japan. You can just really pretty much do as you feel should, and Japanese do the same, you know. So I just wanted to dispel a few myths and present the country that I felt was really approachable. Long answer to your question, and yes, so Japanese Farm Food is in English. It's in French, it's in Dutch, and now it's in Japanese, a thinner, abridged version. And then I have Preserving the Japanese Way. That book was, I wrote it about, there's the words don't really translate out well, but I guess about quick pickling more, and then about preserving we call hozon shoku. Quick pickling is a salt, basically a salt based pickle, though we do have some vinegar based, but the vinegar base will also have a salt component. Okay. So the salts in Japan are salt, miso, soy sauce, fish sauce. Fish sauce is a little bit more uncommon. I do use it a lot. There's only two areas that make it. It's kind of experiencing a little bit of a revival in Japan. I talk about it a lot in the media.
Is Japanese fish sauce different from other fish sauce from other countries?
Well, better in that it's better, I think. I mean, different in that it's better. Different in that it's better, I think. Just because, well, Japan is a land of fish. And Japan is a land of artisans. And so everything they do about fish or about the sea, maybe it's a land of sea. And it's a land of fermentation that's been doing fermentation for thousands of years. And most of the modern methods pretty much solidified in Edo period. So that's several hundred years ago, 500 to 300, I can't really remember the dates, but so they just do things so well and so thoughtfully, and they have a culture of a long culture of fishing. When they fish, they know that that fish could be eaten raw. So there's this whole different approach to the fishery industry. There's a cleanliness. There's a thoughtfulness. The fish is fresher, really. I mean, it's the best in the world. I don't want to speak to other political issues, you know, but so I won't use the word responsible, you know. Okay, well, we'll just get off that. But so the fish sauce in Japan, there's many kinds. I mean, almost every fish or shellfish can be made into fish sauce. Basically, they're three-year fish sauces. They're aged in cedar barrels. Small cottage industry in two areas of Japan, one in the north called Akita, and they use different names for the fish sauce, even though it's essentially the same thing. It's a fish and salt and three-year fermentation. And then in the south, in Ishikawa Prefecture, has probably the most varieties of fish sauce. So that's another thing I'm trying to get to the United States, because there is not a lot of artisanal fish sauce out there,
yep.
You know. And it's sort of astounding that there was one. Daryl Cordy in Sacramento had one kind of fish sauce, Japanese fish sauce available, because he does go to Japan. And I bought it in Japan on Amazon.jp, and it was the only one that I've seen around that has MSG in it. So it was like, yeah, the one we had in America had MSG in it. Very great, yeah. But anyway, there's nothing available yet now. So
cool. I've been cooking more in general, but also starting to use fish sauce more, just as a flavor component, not in any particular type of
exactly.
food, but across
just
the spectrum.
Yeah. And it's exactly, so the Preserving the Japanese Way book, I started out thinking I'm going to write this little pickling book. It was going to be much shorter, 75% of Japanese farm food. It ended up to be longer, and I had to cut it down. But what happened was, I realized as I was researching it, and I was traveling around Japan and getting, you know, just meeting people and talking about it, but also as I was researching the different preserving methods specifically that just are not available in English, and I just, like, sometimes it would take me one day to get into one method, you know, and I don't go work all day long researching this one method. And not all of those methods came into the book as recipes, but they came in as methods that, you know, so I didn't make them lots of times, but I just wanted to present them there as a method that I made, and that anybody who was a fanatic like I hear the Brooklynites are, you know, and I know a lot of chefs are, then, hey, here's the method, go with it, you know. And because I wasn't going to be doing another preserving pickling book for several years, and so it was kind of a now or never kind of thing. So, a lot of those things, you know, yeah, there's no English information about them. But also, I separated the book. When you're writing a book, you have an idea of how you're going to write it, what's going to be in it, but then there comes a time where you have to make the decision of how is it going to be organized? What's the approach, you know?
Yes.
Is it seasonality? How do you, and seasonality changes throughout the world. So I finally got it that I was going to separate it by method of preserving or pickling. The medium. So there's the salt chapter, the miso chapter, the soy sauce chapter, the fish sauce chapter. And then I, you know, slowly start grouping things like vinegar, persimmon, and something else. I forgot, you know. So, and I talk about how, like, miso is made and how soy sauce is made. There's a recipe for making miso, not for soy sauce, because there's a whole element there that's quite not as easy to get done personal basis. It was important for me to showcase the makers, because so many of these makers, you know, become less and less and less and less these traditional artisanal makers. But the really exciting thing is that the 30-year-old contingent of they've come back to their father's or mother, generally a father, mother business or grandparents' business. And so there will be a continuation. And so, again, that's a thing that I talk a lot, like on the Japanese media, because something that really should be lauded. And so a lot of these people, they've gone to college or they've gone off and do other businesses. And then they come back realizing that, you know, this is the family business that they should not let die. And so I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, definitely. I think, yeah. I mean, we're seeing some of that in America as yeah. well. Not necessarily family businesses, but people that are going to the traditional methods of fermentation
Absolutely.
Or curing
Absolutely.
Meat or yeah. Yeah. whatever it may be and building new businesses.
Right,
from.
Because we didn't have as many family businesses. These businesses yeah. were in their grandparents and maybe great-grandparents, you know, and so them dying is sort of, you know, heartbreaking, you know. But the really neat thing is that, or the great thing is that, like with fish sauce, they had the stock. So grandma, grandpa, or mom and dad, they had these big barrels of stuff that hadn't been pressed out. And so it wasn't like they had to, like, start anew. You know, they already had stock, and they had the wherewithal, and they, you know how. And so I think that's really exciting.
Now, this is kind of on a related note, but are you seeing people that are kind of taking these traditional methods and putting new twist on them? Or
No.
Just
absolutely not.
Okay.
No. Yeah. And that's, I guess, something that I find, that's what I love about it. And that's the trouble I have with, I guess I'm also, I feel like, these methods have been going for several hundred years, and so why screw them,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, I see all this freaky fermentation happening, and gonna say I don't quite understand it. Gonna say I don't think it actually tastes very good, and I won't name names, but I've had a lot of strange tastes, and I'm not really going on board with that.
Yeah. Why do you think, I guess,
and it's not—they're not necessarily delicious. I'm going to say.
Yeah. Well, although I was thinking in the beer, because I come from home brewing
okay.
beer, and
yeah.
still involved. I do a lot of other fermentation too, but I think actually a lot of what brewers are doing these days is going back to things
uh-huh.
that happened 200 years ago.
Right.
You know,
and especially with cider makers. Also, we're going back to traditional ciders, especially in America now, where we used to have. A lot of, you know, those really sweet ciders, now we're going back to more traditional ciders.
Right.
Which is really interesting.
So in the cider, I mean, we were talking about the apples, and you know how there's not so many, but the heritage apples are, you know, for the last 20, maybe more 10 years,
yeah.
they're coming back.
Yes.
And that's so exciting
because yeah,
they're
that's a,
native.
That's a conscious, yeah.
Yeah. So is that happening with, are they using those for
yeah.
cider too?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a conscious effort on the cider maker's part.
So great.
There's one of the cider makers we talked to, actually, they have a program where they are trying to like bring back specifically, what do they call it, like the heirloom apples.
Yeah.
People just
heirloom, right,
people just
exactly.
kind of
yeah,
find
yeah.
on the side of the road and are like, what is this? Let's make,
right,
let's
right,
breed
right,
it and
right,
make sure
right.
there's more
yeah.
of this.
Yeah, that's so exciting. Because yeah. those are our treasures, you know. So I live in Japan, and I don't know as much about America anymore, but I did go to a program at Slow Food Nation years ago in San Francisco about the apples. And then the Good Food Awards, I was just there, too. And the apples are, you know, big focus of that. Yeah, so it's really exciting that it's continuing.
Yes. Yeah. And in New England, in New York State, but other states, there are a lot of apple trees that were either originally in an orchard or have just gone wild. So
yeah.
there is a lot
right.
of stock,
right. Right.
you know, to kind of continue
right.
with or rediscover.
Yeah. yeah. So that's what we do not have. And that the just really sad, sad story is there's almost zero organic fruit in Japan. There's citrus fruit, there are some growers because chemicals came after the war, they were pushed on Japanese yeah. farmers and orchards, and you know, once you start putting chemicals on trees, to go back to an organic production, it takes like 7 years to molt off all those chemicals, and so you're after about 3 years of no chemicals, then the production really drops. And then who can push through 4 years of almost no production to get the trees back to a healthy state? And so there was one famous Apple guy who did it, and he ended up like a day laborer in Tokyo and got his teeth kicked in. He wrote a few books. He's a real character. These apples are sold out for years, and you know you can't get on a new customer list. And some people have tried to follow him, but I don't think they're going to continue because those people have to go through the 4-year fallow period. And the citrus growers, they are all in the south, and so they were able to do it through making up their income and fishing, you know. So we do have amazing Japanese citrus and citrus trees and different varieties, but apples, and forget it. Sad.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, the executive producer of Heritage Radio Network, also the host of Full Service Radio, and I want to talk to you about brandy. I was lucky enough to visit Louisville, and we all know Kentucky is whiskey territory. However, the best thing I had to drink was brandy. I got to visit Copper and King's Distillery, and they make pure copper pot distilled American brandy aged in Kentucky bourbon barrels, matured with rock and roll. That's right. Sonic aging. They're playing music to the barrels. The stuff is double distilled, non-chill filtered, unadulterated by bois, sugar, or caramel color. And this stuff is feisty, rambunctious, with a long, smooth finish. The stuff isn't made exactly in the style of an international brandy or a cognac. It's more along the lines of an American whiskey. I can really be honest here and tell you, I'm not just reading you an ad, I'm giving you a tip. American brandy, you're not seeing it everywhere. Copper and Kings is doing it incredibly well, and they're cool people. The distillery is full of incredible art. Like I said, they're playing rock and roll to the barrels. So again, Copper and Kings, pure copper, pot distilled American brandy, aged in Kentucky bourbon barrels. That's copperandkings.com. Drink it neat, put it in a cocktail, sub it for your brown spirits, experiment, have fun, get funky. This stuff is awesome.
Welcome back to Foment About It.
Episode 148.
We're playing an interview with Nancy Hachisu, who was visiting Brooklyn last week all the way from Japan. Back to Nancy.
So let's go back to Japanese fermenting.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of the fermentations in Asia or, you know, in that part of the world, obviously fermentations are different in various parts of the world. There's very unique fermentations that don't happen anywhere else in Peru, for instance. And the same thing, I think, occurs in Asia, in particular Japan. So let's start with natto.
Uh-huh.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Natto, yeah.
So I love natto.
Yeah.
You don't see it here very often.
No.
I've only had it actually at restaurants that will make it from scratch, typically.
Uh-huh, right. Well, that's
I actually
good.
Have never bought it commercially. I suppose you can here, probably in New York City.
Yeah, unfortunately, the natto you buy commercially, except for if you get it from Megumi Natto in in Sebastopol, California, and they do have mail order, the natto has been frozen, mm-hmm. and so it's funkified. So it's not a good benchmark to try that natto.
Yeah,
better
I had
to
it,
go.
The last one I had was in a restaurant in Portland, Oregon. Actually,
where?
That
oh,
makes
really?
It.
Who?
Yes, I have to look in my phone to see.
Was it a Japanese woman?
I don't know.
Who
it was a
bentos?
Restaurant.
Huh.
I want to say I have to look it up.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
My son lives in Portland. I go to Portland a lot.
Oh, so, okay. Yeah, yeah. I'll look it up and see what if you've been there or had it. So tell us what is natto. I think that's something that's not very familiar in this country, and I don't know about Europe, but it's.
Actually, there's a guy in France making natto, doing a really good job. Yeah, and I haven't tasted it, but he seems like a really cool guy. And he, like, you have to order it.
Yeah.
And he's somewhere, I feel like he's, like, in Burgundy. But, and I hear there's somebody in New York making it, too. Somebody told me recently.
I have to, we're going to have to chase them down.
Yeah, I don't know. Have you heard about him?
It's not
New York. I think it's New York State.
Okay.
Yes. And I have a note someplace. Somebody told me about it. I'll look in my notes, too. Anyway, natto. Now, I might get some of my facts wrong, but natto are steamed soybeans that, if packed in rice straw, will naturally become fermented and sort of dormantly slimy. And so, actually, good natto is very delicious. I had some natto. There's a woman in San Francisco, Mariko, I forget her last name. She has a company called Aiden, and she's making koji natto. It has some like kombu and maybe some carrots, and it was absolutely delicious. But not so many people, and that happens. I think probably the first time it happened, organically, and so farmers would preserve their cooked soybeans like that. Now modern, that's still being made. It's natto still being made in the straw. Small cottage industry, not very common, but now more likely they're going to inoculate the soybeans with the spore, the natto bacillus, whatever the technical term, and you keep it at a sort of warm temperature for, I think it's like a day and a half, I can't remember, it's not a long thing, couple days or so, and then it stays. Then you let it rest in the refrigerator, and then you eat it by whipping up the slimy threads, and then you add a little bit of maybe mustard and soy sauce or dashi, and then just a little bit of seasoning, eat it. Typically, so Japanese food, there's kind of two. As many profiles. I always think of Japanese food as two kind of main profiles that sort of also reflect the Japanese people. There's this really elegant kind of food like this kaiseki and very clean flavors like tofu. I have to say, by the way, I tasted some tofu in San Francisco. It's the first time I've eaten American tofu, and I had to spit it out. It was so horrible. Oh, my God. Now, was Japanese tofu sold here?
Not fresh made.
Please, we need tofu here.
I find that tofu doesn't have a lot of taste.
No taste, no flavor, and actually bad flavor. That's why I just spit it. I was like, ah. But also, the texture is really bad. Tofu in Japan is like custard.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, we like the silky tofu.
Yeah. But anyway, that's a different thing.
I know there are some restaurants in New York City that
yeah, actually,
really, it's few and far between.
Yeah, I mean, making yosei tofu, which is fresh tofu, is without the form. That's really mindlessly easy. You need to start with a good soy milk, which is another problem. Our company has soy milk, shelf stable six. Not my company. I mean, the people I know.
Yeah.
Organic, 6-month stable soy milk, but America has so many regulations about the packing and the this and the that, so I don't know if it's going to come in or not. But so there's this elegant side to Japanese food, like sashimi, tofu, these elegant foods. And then there's the funky, wild flavors of natto. Even miso is very wild in its boldness, and lots of fermented fish sauce, too. And that's also part of the Japanese character. They do have two sides. They can get really wild.
So tell us about other fermented fish products that you find in Japan. Because that's another thing that we don't see
Yeah, so it's going to be heavily salted and also often involves rice bran or some miso or something, and then rice bran typically, and then it's just packed in for a long, I mean, could go for years, 3, 5, 7, and often eaten with shochu because it's sort of it goes well with alcohol.
And shochu is the it can be made from different sources.
Exactly,
but it's a distilled beverage.
It's made from different grains, and it's a distilled alcohol. But it also, so back to Japanese fermenting, rather than natto, natto is actually something that people can make. They can get the spores from various sources, cultures for health, and
I think Gem Mountain or something. I have to look up that. Okay. But yeah, you can get.
And Mitoku, I think, sells it too. I mean, it's very easily obtainable online. I think it's one company's spores, and in fact, should not be put off by the fact that the spore is a powder, because the spore labs have been happening in Japan for almost since the turn of the century,
well,
I think.
That's also Koji, Aspergillus, right?
So they're all different spores. So yes, I was just going to talk about Koji. Koji is the Japanese... What sets Japanese fermenting apart is that is Koji. So they have some other spores like the natto spores. And those are spore... Koji is one kind of spore that's been harvested from... It was a wild spore. And I do have some friends who are doing sake, harvesting wild spore from the rice stalks. Though one Koji producer told me that that was not true Koji. I don't know. But, right. And I asked my sake people, and I never got an answer. So, yeah. And I didn't backtrack it. But anyway, so yeah, those. I was a little bit put off, like, oh, God, these are all in labs? But and they've been doing it since the 1900s. They just started the because, especially for Koji-related fermentation, and probably natto too, because natto you can't ferment it unless you have the rice straw. That's the only place that has it naturally. And I did do rice straw. It didn't get as slimy as it could have, but also the temperature control situation was a little bit dicey. But anyway, the Koji, yeah, it was a naturally occurring spore that now has been... They've isolated what's the best Koji strain for sake, what's the best Koji strain for shochu, miso, soy sauce. Shochu also uses Koji, as does sake, as does meeting. Rice vinegar, if you can't buy rice vinegar here that's been fermented from in-house made organic sake. Our people are bringing it in. It's a crime that you can't have us in America. I don't know why. It's also very rare in Japan. But yeah, Koji is the spore that it's a spore that allows a sweetening process to happen. And then, yeah.
Because it converts starches to sugars. Yeah. Kind of what some of our, like when I make beer, the enzymes that are present in the barley will do that for it.
Right.
But rice doesn't have those enzymes present, so you have to do something.
So, exactly, And it's not a yeast.
It's cool.
It is really cool,
You know, that someone at some point in time discovered that.
Yeah, and I haven't gone that far to figure out where to Koji.
I'm most curious about the natto. Who was like, oh, this is fermented, let's try it.
Well, I know, actually it was kind
slimy.
Of...
slimy, let's try
Right. Yeah, well, it actually is very appealing. But again, you got to remember, that these foods are made... I mean, rice is the meal.
Yeah.
Okay, so these foods are all side dishes. So rice is the meal. And so everything, then we never put soy sauce on rice, never flavor the rice. Well, you can have fried rice and things like that, but we'll put some of it. But so you're going to eat your rice with these salty things with it, you know? So you have to think of it like that.
Yeah.
That you don't just like mad, just don't.
So it's more like like we consider salt or other seasonings.
Exactly.
Like seasonings for
Rice. Yeah. So, I mean, you and I don't necessarily need to have a big bowl of rice every day, you know, but my husband and sons do, you know, and so they look at all foods, and so that's why the food is saltier than I would care to have, you know, because they're going to be eating it with a much bigger mouthful of rice, you know. So,
So you mentioned that you often have alcohol with meals and that people, there's a difference in maybe what some people eat. With alcohol. So what type of alcohol do you typically have on your dinner table in Japan?
I drink wine, actually. We don't eat Japanese food every night, but we eat all kinds of food. But my husband drinks bourbon. He's a big bourbon fan these days.
Is that pretty commonly available now, do you find?
I bring it from Brooklyn. But there are some online liquor sites. Mm-hmm. He's also a big Grappa fan, and he's got this big story about the lady in the bottle. I mean, you know, God knows, who knows. Yeah, I ignore him. Whenever somebody comes to say, "What do you want? Bring Tadaki some bourbon, please." I think that But sake is very important to keep alive, and it's something that, depending on how busy I am on my book tours, I really try to put sake into dinners, or and I do promote it in my books because the sake producers are jun, and sake consumption is way down in Japan, but the great thing is up in the United States.
We have a couple of sake producers in the United States.
I haven't had
any of that sake, and I certainly, while I
sake,
I do enjoy sake, but I'm certainly not an expert on it. I know I've been thinking about taking some classes because I feel like it is, compared to even wine or, you know, certainly beer, it's a different, that you have, it would be nice to train your palate towards kind of the delicacies.
That's exactly the word, yeah. And if you were looking for something, Wines of Japan is an importer, and they're very responsible about how they source their sake, and it's a Japanese family who are based in America. And the problem I've found with, this is an ongoing issue, is that sake doesn't travel well, even much more so than wine. Shochu probably, it travels much better as well.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot more of that.
Yeah, and I think that shochu is probably something that's really appealing to places like Brooklyn or Portland. I think you'll see, and shochu has experienced a huge revival in Japan. I think you'll see a lot more artisanal shochus hitting the States. The sake, though, it's so important, yet what I found is it's really disappointed by the sakes here. And I'm just making up this wild story, but there's one thing, is definitely they've been damaged in process, in transit.
Mm-hmm.
And across the board, about 30% loss of quality. And there's a funk factor that's unpleasant. But I also feel like there is something underlying about the choice of the sakes that are being brought here that, I mean, I was eating sushi in the early 80s, and that was the time of the hot sake. And there's that icky
that
flavor that, you know, that somehow we liked, God knows why, until my one sushi bar gave me a taste of the cold stuff. Like, what? You know, I want the good stuff, you know. But so I feel like there's some sort of a vestige of that funky taste that somehow that the whole climate of people drinking sake still have that in their brain. And so somehow the sakes, and there's also, I have heard it from people, people choosing sake for dinners, and they, American friends or something, and they feel like there should be something big flavored to go with the food. And in fact, I feel like the sakes I have at, I mean, the best restaurants or we have at home, that the best sakes are, I mean, they say that sake should taste close to water. And so it's that quaffability that's like, oh, it's so delicious. And I just don't get that when I am here as much. And so
Definitely that sake has that weird taste.
Yeah, right? Yeah. No, it should be. And so typically I have it when we go to the soba restaurant that our friend has, and my son is an apprentice there. We've known him for 20 years since my son was born, and he does dinners at Japanese too. And he's just, and his choice of sakes is always, you know, so beautiful. And so, I mean, that's where I drink sake mostly.
That's interesting. I actually find the shochus here actually do taste close to water. Is that the way that they're supposed to taste?
Shochus, there's all sorts of ranges of shochu. Shochu as a mixer is more like a vodka. It doesn't have the punch of the eau de vie, as it's a little bit more like a vodka, I guess. But I think that what you want to look for is some aged shochus. I actually never liked bourbon or shochu, but now I like them both because of having better ones, frankly. And so there's an aged barley shochu. It's got a slightly clear brown not as dark as bourbon, you know, not as dark as scotch, the slightly clearish brown. There's a really interesting chestnut one. That's very special. Daryl Cordy gave me that, and I took it home. My college age son was like, whoa, where'd you get that? Can I have some? You know, the rice shochus are probably the easiest ones to jump into for a shochu neophyte. The mixer shochus, you're not going to drink straight, you know, so, and there's also the ones that are sold as white liquor, and those are used for making cordials. Okay. You know, you add fruit and sugar and let the, like, ume.
And infuse it, kind of.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Why do you think there is a shochu kind of revolution going on here?
Actually, they are very good marketing, and they, again, going back to the cheap sake thing, the men, the salary men on the trains, a lot of women say they stink like sake, cheap sake, and they think it's really gross. A lot of young women have an aversion to that smell. And so, and young women can't afford a nice bottle of sake. And so, shochu is more of, is, doesn't have, on the less expensive spectrum, doesn't have the unpleasant overtones, and is a really good mixer. And so it actually came as a, not as a straight drinker, but as a mixer, and they marketed young women. And so it was hip, cool, you know. And then the young women are drinking it, so the young men who want to get with the young women, of course, they better be drinking it too, because those Japanese men, those young guys, they're happy to just follow what the girls are doing. They're not like those bossy American women. Stereotype.
So what are some of your favorite ferments in Japan, traditional ferments?
Well, of course, ume is the sour plum, which is actually apricot. That's I make umeboshi every year, and I make miso. Miso, I love the fact that it's so forgiving. Actually, I love things that are forgiving, because and that also sort of tests you, because sometimes my ume, when it's brining, it gets, I forget it, or it's, oh shit, the ume, oh my god, I'm so busy, and then it's developed a little bit of a kind of floating,
like a pellicle. Well, that's what we call them in beer.
Pellicle. Yeah, a skin.
Yes.
A mold skin, which I carefully take off, and I'm thinking to myself, Nancy, if you had just gotten it sooner, it would take less time, because you have to really carefully take it off, and you're just kicking yourself. So I feel like it's such a barometer. These things are such a barometer of life, mm-hmm. you know, and. Can I do it better next year? And you get one chance at it. There's this grandma that my Fuji television person wants to take me to. She's been making umeboshi. She's like in her 80s. So, but if you think about it, you have a finite number of times you can make it. This one, you know, like ume comes once a year, or the daikon time is once a year. The persimmon time is once a year, you know? And how many more times will I have to do it? And how many times will I have in the space of my lifetime? It's kind of an amazing thing to think about, you know, that, like, I can do it maybe 20 more times or so before I'm going to start giving up, but maybe more. But the persimmon, I'm really, 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 really excited about the whole dried persimmon and persimmon vinegar thing, because we also... I know a lot of people in the United States have had trouble with it because of climate differences, because of maybe varietal differences. For us, it's like it matches our country, our climate. I just peel the outside of a tannic persimmon, leaving the leaving the top stem tea, and then I just hang it under the eaves, and again the nails are still there from grandma or great grandma, and my husband never made these, you know, and he would hang it in some other random weird place and they would go bad, and I was like, I'm gonna hang them up there, and then I found the nails. I was like, yay, this is so exciting, I can put it where that's where they're supposed to go, you know. And so I love that. He never made, the family also never made persimmon vinegar, but I heard about it from another friend, and I've been making that. And
now, with persimmon vinegar, are you, like, basically juicing the persimmons, or kind of
them
whole? Or
sticking them in whole. So, okay. And I think that there might be some, in Western countries, especially in America, there's a lot of idea about washing things. So people might, you know, make a big mistake about washing the fruit. And I didn't write that caveat in the recipe, for instance, because I didn't even think about it. But my husband and I were just talking, and he mentioned that. I was like, oh, I should have warned people, don't wash the fruit, because what's on the outside of the fruit, which is like a almost a dusting of a slight white, you know, white sort of...
Can't even...
Right. I mean, I'm a big proponent of the no wash. You just stick persimmons in a of, you know, ones you've picked, ones that are falling on the ground, so they're mashed up, or, and don't worry about leaves or whatever, or any debris, but, and hopefully you're putting in both, we don't use those Hachi and Fuji words, we say tannic and non-tannic, but you're putting them all, different varieties, hopefully in the pot. I think it helps with just the different wild yeast and things, and then, excuse me, and then you don't juice them, but yes, every day or every other day you should squeeze it and macerate it, and so then it does quickly convert to juice with some solids, and of course the seeds are solids, you know, and the stems, and it's covered. You put it in the sunny area, like all fruit vinegars. I mean, in the day I made pineapple vinegar and apple vinegar from the cuttings and sugar and water, but this is just a no water, no sugar thing because it has a lot of sugar.
And moisture.
Yes, exactly. Right. Breaks down very quickly. Within a week, it's completely liquefied. And then just keep tasting it and stirring it. I mean, I do it every other day. And then, you know, it'll start just to... I don't know the chemical parts of all of this so much. I'm just more of a farm wife type of, you know. It's working good, okay. But there's some, you know, the CO2 is happening, and then and it becomes like, oh, I want to make a cocktail from this, you know. And then when the vinegar notes, come out, then it's, I stop. And I cover it. I leave it, let it sit. And it develops, it'll never would develop a true mother, but it develops like this sort of a gelatinous white film that, and after you press it, and then I leave it for a few months, and then press it through gravity, let it just drip out, and then I do squeeze it a little bit in cheesecloth. There's some, you know, controversy about how much, you don't want too much solids to come out, you know, things like that. But anyway, and then the mash is a really great pickling medium.
Yeah, because it's full of all kinds of...
Yeah, exactly. So, and sometimes it can get some molding in it, but I do keep the mash in the refrigerator. And the white mother, thin gelatinous mother, will rise to the top after, and so it sort of protects the mash.
Yeah,
you know. And if there's any molding, then you take it out. I think that mash is really fantastic for pickling daikon or turnips. A quick pickle that you know, maybe it's going to be a week-long cure, but something that you would taste, you would cut it down a little bit, and then you taste it. Really delicious. Really awesome. Yes.
Lots of new ideas. All right, so we're going to wrap this up, but thank you so much
for being on and for having me.
We're actually in the White Hotel in North Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Brooklyn Brewery.
Yes. So, again, this has been Nancy...
Hachisu. It's like a sneeze.
And if you would like to find out more about how to preserve traditional Japanese way, her book Preserving the Japanese Way is available pretty much anywhere books are sold. If you can't find it in your local bookstore, please ask. And please ask for it. So great. Thank you so much. Thank you. Okay.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of Foment About It, Hampton Radio Network.
We'll be back next Monday with Bart Watson, staff economist from the Brewers Association. I'm super excited about next week as well.
We're going to talk about, can home brewers predict the future in beer? See you next week.
Cheers.
Foment About It.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.